This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Sam Fenwick. Coming up today, as we embark on the first full week of 2025, we're talking about global trade. Global shipping is crucial for maintaining supply chains. We'll look at how soaring company profits have led to an increase in shipbuilding. Could the $15 billion merger deal between Nippon Steel and the US Steel be back on after the two companies filed lawsuits challenging the block? And also today.
I don't like it personally because I do have a car in Brooklyn.
It's a ripoff. We're paying taxes already.
Regular day of going into work, another $9 kind of sucks.
Trying to make people make use of the subway, I think it's a great idea.
As New York City introduces a $9 congestion charge, we'll speak to the man who introduced one for London more than 20 years ago. And while we're on air, we're expecting Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to announce his resignation. He's due to speak in about 15 minutes and we'll bring you that as it happens. First, though, today, we're examining how global shipping is set to grow this year. Ship owners have recently placed orders for a record number of container vessels, driven by a substantial increase in profits, liner company earnings and uncertainties surrounding longer transit times for major east-west routes may have contributed to a surge in container ship investments. As we hear, though, across 2025, there could be the potential for trade wars between the United States and China. So what impact might that have on the shipping industry and global trade dynamics? Jonathan Roach is from Braemar. It's an expert in shipping investment, and he explains why orders are up.
There's a couple of factors involved here. First of all, shipping lines have cash. So in terms of ordering new tonnage and new equipment, that isn't a problem. And also, I think really what's driving it is the uncertainty over the longer transit times driven by Red Sea avoidance that we've seen in 2024. So what we've seen this year is about 4 million TEU capacity ordered, even with underlying overcapacity. So it's been quite a shock to the system. But with the Red Sea avoidance, we've seen that oversupply really has been eradicated in 2024. And I think with the uncertainty in terms of timing of when the Red Sea would be available to container shipping, I think shipping lines have taken the initiative to mitigate a long-term closure of the Red Sea.
So do you think that they're anticipating that the Red Sea is going to be closed to them effectively for quite a long time to come?
I think it's a possibility of that because initially in the beginning of 2024 when the diversions were beginning, we probably weren't expecting them to last 12 months. You know, by the 6 months, we would probably see a normality of it. But that hasn't been the case. And I think uncertainty is increasing. And I think that has driven the investment in tonnage.
And so liners need more vessels because they're having to go longer distances. Is that kind of what's basically behind this?
Yeah, that's correct. So we've estimated about 10 million TEU capacity has been impacted by Red Sea avoidance. So in terms of the cellular fleet, that's about a third, 33% of the fleet has been impacted. So for example, on Asia Europe, that would be Shanghai to Rotterdam, the average transit time to go around the Cape of Good Hope is increased to about 100 days on a full loop, so it's about 50 days. So that's an extra 8 to 10 days on Asia Europe. And on the Asia-US East Coast via the Suez Canal, which will now have to be diverted via Cape of Good Hope, that's adding another another week on the transit time. So to maintain a weekly frequency for liner companies, they've had to add more ships and tonnage to existing services to keep them ticking over on a weekly basis.
Well, listen to this. This is an interview with Johan Sigsgaard. He's head of ocean products at Maersk.
Okay. I think the year 24 has been a year with a lot of volatility for us. Started basically with the Red Sea crisis at the end of 23, setting a very different agenda for 24 than what we anticipated just a few months prior that happening. And that has drived, combined with actually a quite strong demand, that has driven a much better year than anticipated for us.
Are you expecting the Red Sea disruptions to persist into 2025? You know, how is that impacting your operations and even customer relations?
Yeah, it's very hard to predict, as you can imagine. But we expect the situation to continue as is into 25. I think for our customers, after initial months of disruption where they had to adjust to longer lead times, most of the customers I speak to now have actually been able to adjust their supply chain to this new situation. So I think for them, it's actually very much around stability now, as they have gotten used to this situation. And that's what they are talking to us around, how to basically preserve that stability to the extent possible.
The global economy is going through a lot, isn't it? I mean, we're seeing reports of record-breaking cargo volumes heading into the US. Companies are rushing to beat those tariff increases. Are you seeing the same, and how are you managing that surge in demand?
Yeah, we clearly have seen a strong demand throughout the full year this year, and we're seeing it continuing at the moment. As a consequence of the Red Sea, we have had a lot of capacity absorbed on the longer routes. So our job has been to work with our customers to basically create that space for that extra demand, and that's what we have been working on with the customers throughout the year.
Johan Sigsgaard there was speaking to Leanna Byrne. Jonathan Roach from Braemar is still with us. And we talked about orders going in at the end of last year being higher than they ever have been before. But those orders are going to take, what, 18 months before we see those ships on the sea?
Well, actually, the average lead time now is about 36 months. So you're talking at least 2.5 to 3 years before those larger ships are going to be trading, from signing the contract to delivering the ship.
So isn't there a danger that actually there could be overcapacity in the market in 2 years' time?
Yes, because the uncertainty over the Red Sea is there. So these ships could be delivered when the Red Sea is open. But I think if you look at the composition of the fleet, there's a lot of older tonnage now. And we saw very little container ship demolition in 21, 22 and 23, in fact, 24. So there is an amount of tonnage that can be removed from the fleet to allow for these larger, more efficient ships that are currently on order.
So in 2 years' time, when those ships have been retired and these new ships are online, will we have effectively the same amount of ships, or will there be more?
We'll technically have, if you look at the actual number of ships, we'll have more ships than we have today. Today's order book is about 760 container ships. There's 8.6 million TEU on order. So, yes, we'll have more ships and more capacity in 2 or 3 years' time. But we have to allow for the removal of older tonnage. And I also think the order book has been driven by the need for eco-alternative fuel tonnage. The liner companies are under immense pressure to replace older, less efficient ships with these new modern ships with alternative fuel options.
That was Jonathan Roach speaking to me earlier, and he's from Braemar, which is a shipping investment company. Now, let's get more on the Nippon Steel and US Steel merger. President Joe Biden has blocked the $15 billion deal, but in response to that, the two companies have jointly filed two lawsuits challenging the decision. Ritika Gupta is the BBC's North America business correspondent. She joins us now. Thanks for being with us on the programme. What then are the main allegations made by Nippon Steel and US Steel against Mr. Biden's decision to block the merger?
So the two companies are alleging in their latest lawsuits against the Biden administration that Joe Biden ignored the rule of law to gain favor with trade unions, and that he stopped the Nippon Steel buying U.S. Steel. And that was to pursue his own political agenda during the election season, and that the election season political considerations therefore undermined the what would have been a formal government review of the merger. President Biden, for his part, has said that a strong domestically owned steel industry was essential for national security reasons and for supply chains and defense industries. But the companies have refuted that claim and said that it would actually enhance national security.
And what chance then of these lawsuits progressing?
Well, I think that's, you know, still yet to be determined. Of course, we're going to have incoming Donald Trump coming in. He's also opposing and wants to block the deal and has said on Truth Social, why would they want to sell U.S. Steel now when the tariffs will actually make it more profitable and valuable company? But it is interesting that at the same time, some think that despite Trump's criticism, he's going to have to revisit the decision, given that Japan is such a close U.S. ally.
I mean, I was going to ask you, you know, what does the legal battle mean in terms of diplomatic relations between the United States and Japan? We had some strong words earlier today, didn't we, from Japan's leader?
Yes, I mean, those are the ramifications that they could be a big strain on that US-Japan relationship, Japan being a very close ally to the US. And as you mentioned, the Prime Minister Shiba of Japan expressing concerns about this decision to block the takeover and that the impact that it may have on the trade relations between the two, and also that it could impact future foreign direct investment into the US. And the Japanese government calling Biden's decision incomprehensible, and they're insisting on an explanation as to why there are security concerns as well.
It certainly seems like it's a conversation that is going to rumble on through into 2025, isn't it, Ritika?
Yes, indeed. As we mentioned with Donald Trump coming in, he's opposed the deal. But there are, as I mentioned, some saying that he may have to revisit it. I mean, I was speaking to the political analyst Terry Haynes of Pangea Policy, and he says that he's going to need to look at the fresh... In his view, he's going to want to take a fresh look at the deal because it will really hurt bilateral relationships with Japan, which is something that Trump will want to avoid. And also that Trump will really want to boost manufacturing in the US, and that he will have to look at everything kind of more holistically. But that, again, is just his opinion. And this saga continues, as we've seen it really since December, blowing up.
Ritika Gupta, BBC's North America business correspondent, thank you very much for your time.
What do Tiger Woods, Mark Zuckerberg, and Taylor Swift all have in common? Well, their lives and fortunes are all being discussed on Good Bad Billionaire, the podcast exploring the minds, motives, and the money of some of the world's wealthiest individuals. I'm Xing Xing, and each week my co-presenter Simon Jack and I take a closer look at the world's mega rich, and we try to decide whether they're good, bad, or just another billionaire. From celebs and CEOs to sports stars and tech titans, find out how billionaires made their money and how they use it. Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service. All episodes of season 1 and 2 are available now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts. And click follow or subscribe so you never miss a new episode.
Time. You're listening to World Business Report from the BBC World Service with me, Sam Fenwick. Well, now let's head to Canada, where the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is expected to step down from his role as Liberal Party leader in a news conference shortly. Mr. Trudeau has been under mounting pressure to resign, with opinion polls for him sinking. His resignation would in turn bring to an end his 9 years as Prime Minister at some point later this year. There have been calls for him to go since last month when his finance minister, Chrystia Freeland, resigned on the day of the budget. In her resignation letter, she talked about the government's costly political gimmicks. Well, let's speak to Charlene Varian now. She is an associate vice president at Summa Strategies. It's one of Canada's largest public relations firms and a former staffer in the offices of Liberal government ministers. Thanks for being with us. Keeping half an eye on the press conference. he hasn't appeared yet, but where is it? It looks like a very sort of beautiful house, a Victorian house. Explain
so
to
what
us.
What you're seeing on the screen there is a building known as Rideau Cottage, and it is the residence of the Prime Minister. It is located on the grounds of Rideau Hall, which is the much larger residence of the Governor General, who is the King's representative here in Canada. So this is the place where the Prime Minister frequently does his updates to the public. He'll speak at a podium out in front of that home, and that is where he resides with his three children.
And what's happening? What's been in the run up to this, as a kind of PR public relations person who's worked with high profile politicians in Canada? Why are we seeing this now? We were expecting it sometime this week, but why suddenly now on a Monday morning?
I think that there are a lot of questions unanswered at this point about the decision making process that the Prime Minister himself was undertaking over the last number of weeks, and those advisors closest to him as well. There, you could equally ask why the resignation didn't come last week or perhaps before the holidays, given the mounting pressure. What we know so far this week is that there was set to be a meeting of the Liberal caucus, which is about 150 members of parliament, on Wednesday, a long 6-hour meeting that was intended to be a time when probably his caucus would be pushing him to step aside, as there have been growing calls for that. Why he decided to abruptly put an end to all of this right away this morning, I'm not certain, but I suspect that it had to do with a desire to turn the page quickly and be able to provide or attempt to provide the country with some reassurance that there is a plan and a process underway. It's very important to underscore that this is a time of great uncertainty for Canada and for Canadians. And the reason for that is that about 2 weeks from today, Donald Trump will be sworn in as President of the United States. And he has threatened to impose 25% tariffs on all trade of Canadian products into the United States. If he does this, it would have a crippling effect on the Canadian economy and on people's jobs right across the country. Canadians have lived through 4 years of Donald Trump before and still have the scars to prove it. And so there's a lot of pressure right now for the Prime Minister to demonstrate that even if his leadership is coming to an end, that there is a plan to ensure that somebody, even if it's not him, can defend Canada's interests in that trading relationship.
And when his finance minister talked about costly political gimmicks, was it that relationship with Donald Trump and the US that she was referring to?
She was referring to a number of fiscal policy measures that the government was moving toward proposing that had to do with basically what amounted to checks to citizens. They were going to be about $250 rebate checks that were intended to land in people's mailboxes shortly before an election. And it was being framed as a measure to help Canadians during what is, by all accounts, an affordability crisis here in Canada. But it was something that the finance minister at the time, Chrystia Freeland, felt should not be something that took priority over the country keeping a little bit more cash in the bank in order to be able to deal with any potential economic blowback from whatever Trump may or may not do when he takes office. That was the core of the disagreement there, was let's save that money for a rainy day, not send people checks ahead of an election in a hope that that will make them want to vote one more time for the Liberals.
And so I suppose the next question that everyone will be talking about is who is going to run to replace him?
Indeed. There are, I think, essentially two camps right now of people in the Liberal Party. There are those who, I think, have already begun very quickly to organize, to make calls and build support, even before the Prime Minister has announced his resignation. And there are some who have been doing that for weeks now. And then there are those who believe that the right thing to do is to give the Prime Minister the space and the respect to take his decision before beginning any organization efforts of their own. In a few minutes, that decision of his is expected to be known. And so at that point, I think the floodgates are open. We will start to see people announce their intention to run. And certainly there are a number of ministers in Trudeau's own cabinet who are expected to want to pursue that leadership. Certainly people talk about individuals like the Foreign Affairs Minister, Melanie Joly, the Transport Minister, Anita Anand, and there are many other very capable ministers, as well as people outside of the current Liberal Party who are hoping to run.
And one front runner seems to be the former Governor of the Bank of Canada and the Bank of England, Mark Carney. But he's an MP, is he? So that would be okay, would it?
Well, because he's running for the leadership of the party, he doesn't need a seat in Parliament. And in fact, there's a fair amount of precedent for that. And what would happen if somebody who wasn't a currently elected MP took over the leadership of the party, he would have to find a seat to run in either in the next election or perhaps beforehand in a by-election. But that's one thing that is a bit of a weakness of Mr. Carney, is that he's untested in the political arena. He has never run for office and has never held a seat in the House of Commons. So that would be an uphill battle for him, absolutely.
And presumably the electorate will be wanting someone a bit more tried and tested then, when, you know, in a couple of weeks we're about to see Donald Trump 2.0.
That is the real question, is what the electorate want. Tried and tested is one element of it. I think we are also in an environment now in Canada where voters have come around to the point of view that they have decided they want change. And for them, change looks like not Justin Trudeau and not anybody remotely associated or affiliated with him. Mm-hmm. If an election were held tomorrow, the current leader of the opposition, whose name is Pierre Poilievre, he's the leader of the Conservative Party of Canada, would be elected prime minister in a landslide. It's too soon to say whether that will be the case whenever an election does end up happening, be that later this spring or this summer. But it is, I think, fair to say that it is unlikely that a Liberal will be the next prime minister after Canada has its next election. Okay. So there is a strong desire for change in the country. And all of those who are looking to replace Trudeau are keeping that in the back of their minds as they're planning their campaigns.
Well, Carlene Varian, thank you very much from Summer Strategist for coming on the program. I am, as I say, keeping an eye on that front door. He's still not out. You can follow that story across the BBC World Service. Now, major cities around the world are struggling to manage traffic congestion. In Manhattan, in New York, the average car speed is just 10 miles per hour. To address this issue, the city has become the first in the United States to introduce a congestion charge. Drivers will now pay $9 a day with varying rates for different types of vehicles. Elijah Westbrook is a reporter for our partner station, CBS.
Typically, on an average morning, takes about an hour and 15 minutes.
And that's on a good day for Zahara Duncan, who's an elementary school counselor. She wanted to do a trial run to her school to see what the weekly commute would entail before Monday morning's rush.
I'm always trying to leave work early. Yeah.
But Zahara says thinking about the road ahead is no laughing matter. $9 a day, 5 days a week, adds up to $45 on top of gas. The toll to get through the Holland Tunnel amid other travel expenses, it can be financially daunting.
I certainly will be giving up any ideas of breakfast or lunch.
So budgeting is definitely in your agenda.
Absolutely.
Bayonne is approximately 13 miles from Bed-Stuy.
If you had to get on the train and the bus, what would that look like?
It's very difficult. I'd have to take a bus either to a light rail or the path, and then to three trains.
Zahara battles with lupus, among other health ailments, and commuting in frigid and inclement weather would be a struggle without her car. On our journey to the city, we approach the Holland Tunnel while passing through a tolling gantry that scans her license plate for the crossing. Through the tunnel we go and into Lower Manhattan.
All right, Zahara, so we're almost there. The Central Business District. How do you feel?
I feel p***ed off.
Really?
I do. Just here that I have go. To pay it. There it is.
The remainder of her commute lasts nearly 30 minutes. This week marks a new reality. The New Jersey resident says she's considering taking different routes and perhaps cutting through Staten Island and over into Brooklyn to avoid the toll completely.
Just something else to deal with.
The first of many more tolls to come.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, there's my $45 a week.
That was Elijah Westbrook reporting for CBS. Well, London has had a congestion charge for more than 20 years. Richard DeCanny from the engineering firm Arup, in a previous life, he also worked for the Mayor of London, where the congestion charge was introduced. And I asked him how drivers responded to its introduction.
I think you have to go back to the late 1990s to appreciate how bad traffic congestion was in central London at the time. And there was a general consensus across the political and business community and the public to a large extent that something needed to be done, and an appreciation that congestion was damaging the central London economy. And at the time, traffic in central London was moving, you know, at a similar speed to pedestrians and cyclists. So there was a need to actually do something to make a difference.
But there were claims by London's Chamber of Commerce that said that the congestion charge led to a fall in footfall and revenue, and that actually it could have potentially also encouraged businesses to locate out of the city centre.
Yeah, so there were quite a lot of concerns expressed at the time about the impact of the congestion charge on business, particularly those businesses around the boundary of the charge area. And whilst there are many similarities between London and, say, Manhattan, London has a relatively kind of unique profile where very few people actually drive into the centre of London for work on a daily basis, partly because parking was so difficult. So those people that were driving were choosing to drive and sit in congestion and typically higher income earners. So most people travelling into central London were using public transport. So by understanding the data and about who was using it and who was likely to be affected, you could kind of craft the right level of charge to have the right outcome without necessarily having the negative impact.
And how then did it impact the levels of traffic in the centre?
Well, I think it's really important that congestion charge in London was introduced as part of an integrated package alongside a whole lot of other measures focused on improving public transport, walking and cycling. So this was absolutely not considered in isolation. It was part of a new transport strategy that was all about changing how people in London could travel, with a major focus on greater use of public transport, walking and cycling, and less people driving. And to that extent, the revenue from the congestion charge was hypothecated towards investment in public transport. And when the charge was introduced, there was a significant investment in the bus network, with a major increase in bus capacity, new bus routes, bus priority, that made bus a much more attractive and convenient mode of transport to use.
When you look at Manhattan today, first starting its first business day with a congestion charge, how do you think they need to make it a success, and how do you think they need to sell it to people in New York?
I think it's really, really important that this isn't just seen as a tax and a tax on motorists. It has to be seen as part of an integrated package where many people are benefiting in different ways. And that goes to investment in public transit. It goes to investment in walking and cycling, but also in the local areas of Manhattan that will be benefiting through a reduction in traffic. And that was a fundamental part of the London programme, that measures were taken very, very quickly to make it look and feel better for many different people.
And it has changed over the years, hasn't it? And now reflects emissions and growing concerns over emissions. So Manhattan may find that actually their air quality will improve as well.
So one of the immediate impacts of the congestion charge in London was a reduction in the number of people driving into the central area that reduced congestion. Now, over time, those lower levels of traffic in London have been maintained in spite of population growing and more people travelling overall in London. And that's because people have been using public transport, walking and cycling in larger numbers.
That was Richard DeCanny, one of the people behind the introduction of London's congestion charge. Thank you very much today for listening. Thanks to the producer, Neil Morrow, and the editor today was James Wickham. Join me again the same time tomorrow.
Delve into a world of secrets. The BBC's Global Investigations podcast, breaking major news stories around the world.
A BBC investigation finds that Mohamed Al-Fayed, former owner of Harrods, was accused of raping five members of staff.
Mohamed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
From the top of British society to the heart of global fashion brands.
The former boss of clothing brand Abercrombie & Fitch is accused of exploiting young men for sex.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
Gripping investigations, available to listen to now, with more coming soon. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts and click follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.